Welcome to the Lobot Lounge, the gathering place for the gentlemen nerds. The gentlemen nerds are three entertainment aficionados who know each other through various media endeavors, getting together to talk about all things nerdy, mostly in the vein of film, television, toys, and popular culture. Many topics are discussed, so please be warned, there are the potential for many, many spoilers. If you like what you hear, you can listen to past shows on iTunes or on our website, thegentlemannerds.com. And now, enjoy the show.
Proceed with caution, because there are the potential for many spoilers.
Before creation itself, there were six singularities. Then the universe exploded into existence, and the remnants of these systems of existence itself were forged into concentrated ingots, infinity stones. The space stone, the power stone, the reality stone, the mind stone, the time stone, and the soul stone. These stones, it seems, can only be brandished by beings of extraordinary strength. These carriers can use the stones to mow down entire civilizations like wheat in a field. Once for a moment, a group was able to share the energy amongst themselves, but even they were quickly destroyed by it. Now, Thanos, a titan, desires to possess all six stones and to wield them on a gauntlet forged by the smiths of the gods themselves to alter reality for a terrible, mad purpose. The universe's only hope is the Gentlemen Nerds. That's right, folks. We're back. We're here. And we are going to dive in and talk about Marvel's Avengers Infinity Wars. Oh my gosh, so much to say. Yep. Mind expanding, universe expanding. Here at the Lobot Lounge, we are ready to go. Seated at the table is Aaron Dearive.
God help us, but Red Skull lives.
What? Mark Finn.
Red Skull lives.
And I am Joseph Fatinos, your host and emotional touchstone, starting this episode with the reminder and the confirmation that Red Skull lives. All right, let's dive into this.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Wait. Now, wait a minute. Who's Red Skull again?
For those of you who have just joined us on our podcast, Red Skull Lives has been a sign-off moniker of mine for nigh on 2 years now. Just because I felt that it was appropriate, and I kind of like the villainous character. He's a good foil for Cap, and I thought, surely he's not dead. He very obviously teleported somewhere, and I like Red Skull versus Captain America. I just did. So I wanted him back in Civil War. No. I wanted him back in Winter Soldier. No. I wanted him back in Avengers Age of Ultron. No. And I was touting it. I thought, he's coming back, guys. He's coming back. So as we'll discuss, he finally does make his reappearance into the Marvel Cinematic Universe with Avengers Infinity War. Wow, how do we start this? I guess from
the... Well, and in case you guys haven't already noticed, and you probably already have, we always give the disclaimer, but if you have not seen Infinity War, I know we've already kind of spoiled something for you, please do not listen to this podcast. We will have many spoilers. And be talking about plot and moments.
This podcast is going to be spoiler laden. Yeah.
Yes. Yes. Lots and lots of spoilers. So if you have not seen Captain America, put us on pause. Avengers Civil. Infinity War. Put this on pause. Go see Infinity War, and then come back and listen to the rest of it.
Right. We're going to dive into some of the minutiae of the detail here, because we, these being gentlemen nerds as we are, and Marvel geeks and aficionados, we've followed these movies for 10 years. You know, 18 movies. We've watched it all come together, and the beautiful melding of these characters deserves a cinematic viewing. So don't go, wait for it on cable. No. Go to the theater, please. And see it in the theater.
I agree.
So much. If you're invested in any of the characters, even if you go, I like the Guardians of the Galaxy. They're kind of funny, but I don't really like Iron Man. That's okay. Everyone's in it. Everyone's in it, you know, and it worked out really well. So we really start this film in a very grim help, you know, message being broadcast from the Asgardian ship that we saw at the end of Thor Ragnarok. It's a distress call saying that they are under attack, and this refugee ship essentially, and they're under attack
by a very large ship known as the Sanctuary II, belonging to one Mad Titan Thanos.
Yep.
Yes, and that's where we will begin our review. What did you guys think of Thanos' first appearance in this film?
Well, I got to tell you, I was very, I was quite excited because I didn't know where in media res we were going to open.
Yeah.
And to literally come in 15 minutes after the end of Thor Ragnarok was a little surprising. I didn't know what the gag order's been so strict and there no details about the movie.
Yeah.
Other than what we were shown in the trailer, which we now find out, of course, had some nice bait and switch in it so that it didn't spoil some surprises, which is great.
Yeah.
But to literally it was I think a suitable signifier to open the movie. Everybody'd seen Thor Ragnarok. We'd just seen the Asgardians survive an attack that consumed Asgard. They got out of the way of Hela and escaped, not without significant loss. And so you think, well, but these guys are hardy. They're strong. They're living gods. Surely this is going to be, they'll be able to bounce back. And then to open up with them decimated, with ship in ruins, with everybody that we like, that was left dead, or presumed dead. We didn't see Tessa Thompson,
Valkyrie.
We didn't see the Valkyrie in the amidst the bodies, and we didn't see Korg. But I think the implication was, and if you were on the fence about, well, maybe he didn't kill everybody. Oh no, he just stabbed Heimdall. Oh, he snapped Loki's neck. this was not cool. Yeah. I think it's a signifier for what the movie is. Yeah. It starts out like that so that you don't come in happy and then have all of your joy sucked away. They start out, they give you something to think about right away. So that, I think that was a smart thought.
The threat is important to establish, yeah.
Oh, yeah, no, and by putting him, Thanos, directly against the heaviest hitters, because he's already defeated Thor, he's defeated Heimdall, he defeats Hulk. Hulk lunges at him, and then Thanos proceeds to beat the living shit out of Hulk.
He pummels him.
Yeah. So that absolutely, I think.
Now let's establish right now when we see Thanos right out on the ship on the Sanctuary 2, he's got the Infinity Gauntlet and he's already in possession of the Power Stone, which explains rather neatly how he was able to beat Thor and Hulk so easily. It wasn't just Thanos being Thanos. He had the Power Stone.
Right. Yes.
So let's give credit where credit is due.
It was such a brilliant way to open that to just really establish, because now when it cuts to the other Avengers and you're wondering what the hell is Spider-Man going to do against this guy? What the hell is Captain America going to do against this guy? It was just such a wonderful and brilliant way to really open that film and have everyone going, gah! Normally we save the big Hulk fight, for the end. No. Just here. Oh, you love this guy? This big green guy? He's unbeatable? Watch this. Bam, 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 bam. Okay, there we go. And so, that was, I saw it with my wife and my daughter, and both of them, their jaws were just dropped open like, holy cow.
Right. It was impressive, and while Hulk did get a couple of good smacks in, when Thanos opened up and just really got into it, into the fight, and had that Power Stone and was just pounding him and doing some amazingly quick, fast moves, and that's the one thing that I felt established pretty well on, that Thanos was not a lumbering a massive, can't move very quick kind of a fighter. He was incredibly skilled proportionally to his size. He moved very fast and with some amazing abilities and just really, owned him.
I even love the nice touch of, his big henchman's about to get in, and mm-hmm. and the other one says, "No, no, no, let him have his fun." You know.
Well, since you brought him up, we do meet the Black Order on the Sanctuary too, which consists of Corvus Glaive, Proxima Midnight, Cull Obsidian, and Ebony Maw, who's my favorite, the telepath that Aaron just spoke of. It said, "Let him have his fun." It was Ebony Maw.
He was creepy. He was wonderfully creepy.
Yeah. And we will see them throughout the movie. We'll kind of dive into them a little bit more too. Thanos refers to him as his children, but then again, Thanos called everyone his children. Yeah. You know, like a religious cult leader. He was very much, you know, "You're all my children now," kind of a thing, right?
Yeah.
But so I don't necessarily think they were his flesh and blood.
Right.
They were so varied looking.
And by the way, to be clear, for those of you who saw the opening and have seen the movie and we're like, "Oh yeah, well that's it. That there go the Asgardians." No, lest we forget, Thanos leaves half of whatever he encounters alive, be it a ship, a planet, whatever it is. So half of the Asgardians are still alive.
Right. Which means that the Valkyrie could be in that half. Yeah.
Correct.
Yep. That's a very good point. Because Thanos does, as we come to find out, desire to basically thin the herd. And leave more resources for everyone. We'll discuss more about his motivation down the road.
Is handled very, very well.
Very well, because we were wondering.
What he wants, how he's going about it, it makes a mad, insane kind of sense.
Yeah.
And another thing I'm going to do at some point is, you know, compare this, because it's inevitable, compare it to Justice League. And Thanos was everything that Steppenwolf wishes he had been. I mean, the way he's portrayed, his dialogue, his motivation, his interactions with the heroes. I mean, it was everything that DC would have dreamed to have for one of the main minions of Darkseid. Yeah. We'll talk about that a little bit later. But hell of an opening, fellas. Hell of an opening. I was stunned.
And really, from the very beginning, and I'm sitting there staring at Thanos, because we'd seen him briefly. We've seen him on screens. We've seen him sitting in his floating rock chair on the Sanctuary. This was the Sanctuary 2. But literally, after a very short while, I stopped seeing a giant purple CGI creation, and I just saw Josh Brolin. And truly, Josh Brolin and Zoe, what's her name?
Zaldana.
Zaldana. Uh-huh. Truly had some of the heaviest hitting emotional acting moments and pulled it off. Yeah. I believe, you know, kudos to Josh Brolin for his performance as Thanos. Multifaceted, multi-layered, enjoyable. I mean, I got to say, I spent the weeks leading up to Infinity War shouting to the heavens and to whoever would listen to me, "Screw you, Thanos," because I knew he was going to break my heart. By the end of it, I liked the guy. I mean, he was a likable villain, believe it or not, even though he did horrible, horrible things and broke our hearts, certainly. By the end of it, I understood him, because he was, if not a main character, he was the main character, because he knew exactly what he wanted to do. And we saw his scavenger hunt through the universe to try to pick all these up.
And there's been observations about that from several reviewers, and rightly so. They say Thanos is the main character of this film. Thanos is the star of this film.
Right.
And I agree with that. That is 100% correct.
Yeah.
This movie is about Thanos.
And if we need any more hammering of that point home, jump to the incredible end of the credits at the end of this movie, where it usually says the Avengers will return. In this case, it said Thanos will return.
Yep.
That's what it said at the end of the movie.
Yeah, this movie is Thanos' movie, and they were very smart. One of the best things about the Marvel storytelling that they have adapted to film is that they don't have to spend any part of the clock introducing you to anybody. Yeah. You don't need to know who any of the characters are except Thanos. And so he's given a lot of room to develop. And it's what makes him so layered and nuanced. And also not just in terms of scope, but easily the best developed villain, that they've had to date. Part of it is because we've known about his machinations for a while. Mm-hmm. And we've gotten sort of tentative glimpses of him, but there's not a single new character in the movie, with the exception of Peter Dinklage, that we need to know anything about. And we don't really need to know anything about Peter Dinklage.
Yeah. Yep.
Thor tells us all we need to know in two sentences.
Yep.
So, so why not make this, Thanos' movie? It's going to be, the thing that, going forward, this is remembered. You know, they've made 18 movies so they could make this 19th movie.
It's absolutely true. And speaking of villains, for the longest time, the reigning Marvel, the gem in the Marvel Cinematic Universe of villains was, of course, Loki, who was played, who has been played just with perfection by our good friend, what's
Tom
his
Hiddleston.
Name? Yeah, that guy.
Tom Hiddleston.
You know, that guy. Yeah, Tom Hiddleston. So, and you know, we've watched him. We've grown to love him. I think a lot of people would argue that Loki is a likable villain. He's sort of shades of gray. He's certainly not a black-hearted villain. There's some shades of gray in him. We see Loki at the beginning of this film trying to bargain with Thanos at the beginning, or denying the existence of his space stone that we know he took at the end of Thor Ragnarok. We saw him in Odin's treasure room. He pauses before the Tesseract, and we know he's got it. So he says he doesn't have it. Thor has already been beaten. Thanos threatens to crush his head like an egg in his mighty hand, and then Loki says, yeah, go ahead, do it. I don't care. I hate that guy. And we start to see Loki crack, because really deep down inside, there was that moment in Thor Ragnarok. We talked about it when they were in the elevator, and Thor tells Loki, look, we're two different people. We've grown apart. You're you and I'm me. And I think it's best if we don't see each other for a while. Now that hit him home. That hit Loki home. And especially when Thor said, I loved you. I thought you and it would be you and I together forever. That's how I felt about you. Yep. So flash forward now, and he's watching his brother, screaming in pain, and suffering, and potentially going to be killed. And he turns over the stone. He tells him stop, and he reveals the stone. Of course, being Loki, he had plans upon plans upon plans in his head. And that plan was, no, I've been pausing here because we have a Hulk. Ha ha, get him, Hulk. And of course, we know how that went.
Right. And you know, in as much as, you know, we were saying that this movie's been setting up Thanos, and Thanos is very, very well developed. That's another thing this movie accomplishes. You know, we have spent how many movies reaching this moment of denouement for Loki. Yeah. You know, we've seen Loki's arc. He is from the very beginning. He wanted the approval of his father, Odin, and he actually wanted the approval of Thor. And so he's come now full circle. He's lost everything that he's ever loved. He's lost his mother Frigga. He's lost Odin. All he has left is Thor. That's it. And so it really is just a wonderful, wonderful moment for Loki, which is why, and he is my favorite Marvel villain. I mean, hands down, he's my favorite Marvel villain. And so I loved that moment. It was as much Loki's moment as it was a great introduction for Thanos.
Yes.
And people are of course saying, well, okay, I guess that, you know, Loki's dead. That's it. You know, he's dead. Maybe, you know, comic books are comic books. And as we know from Norse mythology, when those people die, there are places they go to. You know, the dishonored dead go to Hela's realm, and the honored dead go to Valhalla. So since I am convinced that Hela is, of course, not dead, because you can't kill death.
There you go. Hashtag Hela lives.
Yeah, there you go. Hela lives. Yeah, that's all sign off. But I am convinced that we will see Loki again. I think Thor, if they make another Thor movie, and they probably will, I think this is, and they've done this in the comics, by the way. If you're not familiar with the comics, this has been a storyline in the comics. Thor goes to Hela, and he bargains for the dead there, and says, I want this person. And Hela, of course, says, great, I want something too. And then that becomes whatever that story is going to be. So I'm not convinced that Loki is dead for good. I'm not convinced we're never going to see him again.
It was a startling end, though. I mean, in its brutality and raw, bleeding from the eyes as he gasped for breath. You know, as Thanos said, "There's no resurrection for you this time," and you hear the horrible snap of his neck, and it drops him. and like a sack of flour, you know.
Right.
It's just it really is. And Loki got his last words out to Thanos, where he said, "You will never be a god."
Mm-hmm. Yep.
You know? So
I do think we'll see him again.
I hope so.
You know, yeah. Again, God, comics are comics, and sure. So
well, also we'll talk about the full powers of the stones. But you know, the Soul Stone is there now. The gauntlet is there. You could snap your fingers and make reality whatever you want to. And the Soul Stone can bring the dead back to life.
That is true. And I definitely want to address that when we get to that moment when we talk about Gamora, because again, we know it's confirmed there's going to be another Guardians of the Galaxy movie, and it's been confirmed Gamora will be in it.
Oh, is it? So, I didn't hear that.
No. That's one of the things that they're like, wait a minute. Aren't they making another Guardians movie? And isn't Gamora in it?
I knew the Guardians movie, but I never heard confirmation that Gamora was going to be in it.
I wouldn't swear to that, but I remember reading somewhere that they're like, wait a minute, they've kind of spoiled it, because we know Gamora is going to be in, and by the way, in the comics, I believe Gamora is in the Soul Stone, and she is released by Adam Warlock.
And there we have it, folks. I think that we were getting to that point, but Aaron has leaped ahead a bit.
No,
you're good. But that is exactly right. And when we get to the Soul Stone scene, and we talk about what Thanos had to do to get it, and who he got it from, all these things that we'll discuss, that's going to be a huge part of that. So can we table that for now? Because
Let's do it. Yeah. Okay.
On the ship, not only does we meet the Black Order, we lose Loki. Heimdall, in a last-ditch effort to have some hope, uses the power of the Bifrost to send Hulk to Earth. Saves the Hulk. Bruce Banner zaps him to Earth. It costs him his life as Thanos brutally stabs him in front of Thor. So Thor's lost his best friend, his brother, his mother, his father, his planet, his people. He's got no one. And Thor is forced to watch this entire thing happen. And he vows to Thanos. And this is huge, because this is Thor, and it's all about Norse revenge. Because, you know, Asgardian revenge is a beautiful thing. And it drives Thor for the rest of the movie, where he says, you will die for that.
Yeah.
And he means it. When Thor says something like that, folks, he means it. Yep. So let's you know, we can put that to rest. He's very singularly motivated in this movie. And it's a drive for him. And it's just as much Thor's movie, really. I mean, he starts from the beginning and he goes all the way through the end. He's got this great vision quest he has to go on, and he doesn't take his eye off the prize, though. His eye's on the prize, and we'll get to that in just 1 second. So Thor watches this. Hulk is away. The ship explodes, leaving the space littered with the bodies of Asgardians, including our favorite trickster god. Very sad. Very sad. But
yep.
Now, Thanos has two stones. He has the Space Stone and the Power Stone. The Space Stone, of course, hidden in the Tesseract. So, we jump to Earth. We see good old-fashioned Tony Stark and Pepper Potts walking through the park, having to talk about maybe let's have some kids. Hey, let's not have any more surprises in our life. Hey, what's that thing on Tony's chest? I thought he fixed that. Well, Tony's always tinkering, right? What do you guys think about that? About that explanation as to why he put that back?
Tony's motivation, he actually spells it out. You know, mm-hmm. he's been waiting for the other shoe to drop for 6 years.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that I think what was probably more telling for me was just the notion that when we're not watching the movies, these characters continue moving forward and evolving and changing.
That's cool.
It's one of the things that I really like about the movies that has really mimicked the experience of reading the monthly comics is, you know, things happen even when we're not watching the movies. And so that's been so it's nanotech. Awesome. That's great. I think there's a reason for it, which I will talk about later.
Yeah.
But I think there's a specific reason for it. So.
Okay. I like it.
I got thoughts. I got thinky thoughts.
You got thinky thoughts in the thing. Hey, I got a question. Didn't Pepper Potts have some kind of extremist power at the end of Iron Man 3?
Yes, she got better.
Is that the only answer for that? Because I thought for sure that she would take part in the fight because she could turn into fire now or something like that, right?
He made a point of saying, I'll figure out how to fix this.
Yeah.
He made a point of saying that in Iron Man 3, you know? And so the fact that she does not have a metallic sleeve for an arm, you know, we're going to read between the lines and assume that she does not have the extremist power anymore. Which I think is fair and fine. Because honestly, I thought it was a little dopey for her to get it.
I was hoping that it would be fixed because I didn't like it either. But I like how they didn't even bother to go, gosh, sure glad you fixed that extremist stuff. Yeah, I know. Anyway, it was just that. Let's just pretend that really never happened and let's move on. You know?
I think a lot of Marvel fans pretend that Iron Man 3 never happened. So I think we're perfectly fine with saying, okay, look, it's Pepper and everything's just back to normal. But
unfortunately, for that idyllic scene, Doctor Strange and Wong were surprised. They were going to go out to lunch, and they were surprised by the Hulk crashing through the Sanctum Sanctorum, and Bruce Banner in a panic telling them Thanos is coming. Thanos is coming. Now that brings up something else. Apparently, Hulk and Bruce Banner share the same body, more or less. They transform, of course, but they share the same body. Right. And for the longest time, we really didn't realize that they shared the same mind. In fact, in the Avengers 1, it seemed like they were two very separate people. Where he talks about the other guy, not necessarily like me. Where in this one, they're much more fused, where they have the memories of each other. Yeah. Obviously, Hulk experienced the beatdown from Thanos and does not want to come out again. And Bruce Banner was not there for Thanos, but Hulk was. Yet Bruce Banner knows exactly what it is, and Hulk obviously does too. So their brains are melding, their minds are starting to come together. And I had this great fantasy of one day we might see Mark Ruffalo's Hulk dressed up in a suit like Joe Fixit. I would love to see that, you know, and have him talking sentences and being, you know, being that intelligent Hulk or semi-intelligent Hulk or just moderately intelligent Hulk. You know?
Smart Hulk would be awesome.
It would be cool, wouldn't it?
Yeah. Totally.
Yeah. Doctor Strange appears via magic circle and says, we need to talk. And of course, Iron Man is the first time he's ever met Dr. Stephen Strange. So that's a nice little moment. They have really good banter. What do you guys think about their chemistry together? I liked it myself.
This is where the movie takes off for me. Mm-hmm. Watching these two colossal egos crash into each other.
Oh yeah.
I'm not the guy that thought that Dr. Strange and Tony Stark were a lot alike. That is to say, I think they're very egotistical, but in very specific and different ways. And right. So the notion of these guys not quite really getting along from the start is A, classic Marvel comics, and B, entertaining as hell. One of the nicest things about the series is that they have layered in these great character actors at the top of their game with these really signature, interesting, larger than life personalities that they've been able to inhabit. And watching these guys play off of each other has been one of the most enjoyable things of the last 10 years. Mm-hmm. So this was, I was so excited to get this. To me, this is when things really get good.
When Cumberbatch turned to Downey and said, "No shit, Sherlock."
Oh my God!
I loved it. That was just in my dream. Honestly, Stephen Strange turning to, because this is a thing that the rest of the team, for whatever reason, whether it's out of respect or just because they don't want to go there, no one's ever turned to Tony like Stephen Strange did and said, "Look, douchebag." No one's ever done that, so it was wonderfully refreshing to see. Doctor Strange, who doesn't give a shit about Tony Stark, doesn't care who he is.
Right.
It's like, shut up, douchebag. It's like, whoa. Because the other Avengers have been wanting to say something like that to him. I agree with Mark. It's when those two started interacting, it felt like two great franchises were finally coming together. You know, it should have been that way when like Batman encountered Superman, you know, like, oh, wow, check it out. Sadly, it wasn't that way, but
no.
So I think that yes, that's when for me the after that big opening, that great action doom laden opening, mm-hmm. boom, we're off on the story now, they dive right in with characters saying stuff that we love, showing us the who they are. And it went really well. I mean, yes. I wanted more banter between the wizards and Tony, and Hulk and such. But that was a really wonderful moment, a meeting of two great egos and two great Marvel characters, and it went very well. And it was a short scene. It wasn't like this big long drawn out thing. It was a short scene, but so well done. I have a lot of admiration for this movie, which will become very obvious as we continue to talk, but another very well done thing.
Well, in order for them to put all those characters together and those actors together and all that, just all the massiveness of it, everyone thought, oh, the Avengers, Joss Whedon's original Avengers, oh my gosh, what an achievement. This, oh my gosh, you're pulling together, you know, characters, multi-movies, and a whole universe in one giant blender. And it works.
Yeah, there's no wasted space in the storytelling, and it's 2.5 hours long. And we would have all sat there for another 30 minutes if they'd have let us.
Yep.
Yeah. Absolutely. So, and then the pairings. I mean, that's I'm looking at strictly from the story, the script, the choices that the writers and the directors made. But you know, they paired. They knew that there would be this great chemistry between Strange and Tony. So guess what? They paired them. Right. They knew there would be great chemistry between Thor and the Guardians of the Galaxy. So they paired them. I mean, it's like wherever they could, they would take characters that you knew were just, this is the perfect guy to put against these characters. Mm-hmm. And every time, those choices were awesome. Those choices.
Oh, I want a Thor Guardians movie. I want to watch that for 2.5 hours.
Yeah,
that was the goal.
It says it all. Drax, you know, he's not a dude. He's a man, a beautiful, muscular man.
It's like a pirate and a baby with an angel.
You're a dude, you know. It's like if a pirate and an angel had a child. Oh my god. So that's the other thing too, right? The writers had to write those characters so that they continued to be true to the characters that were introduced in other movies. So they had to write James Gunn-like dialogue. You know,
James Gunn actually wrote the dialogue for the Guardians.
Oh, okay. Well, then there you go. Bingo. Brilliant.
He came in and wrote all the Guardians dialogue.
Really?
Or at least worked with the writers to perfect it.
And that is precisely what should have been done. And it was fantastic. Never once did I feel that any of those characters were having to change a little bit because now they're in a different movie with different. No, it was them. That was the Guardians. That is Thor. At least Thor from when we saw him last in Ragnarok. I know a lot of people out there that don't like Ragnarok. It's my favorite Thor movie and probably in my top three of Marvel movies. Yeah. But it was still that guy, that wonderful new Thor that we got in Ragnarok, and it was wonderful. And again, if they brought Taika Waititi into that to work with Thor's dialogue, fantastic. I don't know that they did, but man, it sure seems like they did.
They did successfully manage to siphon what made each one of those characters great, and not sacrifice any of their individuality by bringing them all together and having somebody in the background going, yes, let's do that. And you're like, well, he would never say that. They were all very true to their characters.
And by the way, I want to point out, I love that Wong loves tuna melts. That's my favorite sandwich. So when Wong says, well, I wouldn't say no to a tuna melt, I was like, yes, I love Wong.
Well, I think that, I too think that they got Thor right. I think that his lighter tone does not take anything away from his God of Thunderness at all. And in particular, the movies have done another thing that the Marvel movies in this one did is it gave us space for quiet moments. That's something else that Marvel has always done in their comics to help sort of cement connections. Mm-hmm. And so it's wonderful to see that the Guardians plots continue in this movie, just continue apace, but also, to see, for the, just to go back to where we were, the Spider-Man Iron Man dynamic continues apace.
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. The father son relationship that they've started to build in Homecoming really comes out and breaks your heart, but it really comes out through this film as well. So they're at the Sanctum Sanctorum. Dr. Strange gives them a primer on the Infinity Stones, basically says, here's what's going on. And of course, now we know that Dr. Strange's eye of, we don't talk about that in the podcast. We know what happens that time. We can't say yes. that. His artifact, we'll just leave it at that, is actually one of the Infinity Stones, the Time Stone. Yes. So that's one there too. So he explains them all. And he actually knows kind of where they are, too. He says the Mind Stone is in the Vision's head. So we know that Vision is a target. We know that this Time Stone is a target. So he's coming here to us. So we know that. And, of course, you know, right after he says it, not long after he says it, we start hearing screams. We start hearing rumbles. Dr. Strange's hair twitches. And Tony says very jokingly, are you moving your hair right now? And he says, no, not right now. Where something's coming. And, of course, in a very almost handheld POV type of moment, Tony walks out of the Sanctum Sanctorum, goes down the street. People are running. People are falling. Cars are hitting poles. Help that guy. He's looking up. I know he's having PTSD flashbacks at this point of the Battle of New York because here we go again, right? Turns the corner, and there hovering in the sky impossibly is a giant metal donut, apparently. This gigantic circular ship that is hovering in the sky. And, you know, It's madness. It's madness all over again. So this is everything Tony has been dreading since the Battle of New York. And the good point earlier when we talked about, you know, he's always prepared because he knows that other shoe's going to drop. And here it's dropping. Here it is. We do get a battle on the streets of New York as Ebony Maw and Cull Obsidian, the Hulk-like member of the Black Order, show up to take Doctor Strange's Time Stone. And that fight is actually, I mean, it started off on a great note immediately. And I said, I'm going to love this. I'm just going to love everything about this. I knew I was, no big surprise there. But the minute that Banner could not transform and Tony was like, come on, you're embarrassing me here. He kept saying, come on, big guy, let's go. Come on, let's go. Where are you?
Embarrassing me in front of the wizard.
That's my favorite line. Oh my God. You're embarrassing me in front of the wizards.
Oh, let's talk about Tony's acceptance of the wizards real quick. Because remember, he had a hard time going with Thor and the magic thing. It's not magic, it's science. You know, he seemed to kind of fight against the idea that it could be explained. You know, I could pick this hammer up. I can. He couldn't, but you know what I'm saying? But here he's just like, yeah, those wizards. Okay, let's move on. He didn't have any kind of a quippy, yeah, okay, Houdini, you know, whatever, it's all tricks.
Well, he called them wizards, so I think that just that in and of itself.
But he knew that, I mean, he acknowledged their power. He realized that, yes, we're talking about magic, you know, these guys are doing magic. He walked through a portal to get there. Right. He didn't even question. He was just like, okay, it's part of my life now, you know. Well, so here,
the cloak of levitation admonished him for leaning on the cauldron.
Yeah.
I think that's when he turns around and kind of, I think that's when the acceptance hits. That's when he kind of stops and says,
that's right.
I will allow that. I think that's when he realizes, this is magic. This isn't science.
Exactly.
So that to me is where that happens.
I love that cloak. I love that cloak.
I know the cloak continues to be a fantastic character this movie. And so, and I agree that the fight, and again, this will be a note that I hit over and over again, is the fights, how they choreographed the fights, the stuff that was going on, the things that the characters were doing. If there is one thing that the Russo brothers have proven now over several films, is that they are the absolute masters of the action sequence.
In particular, making that stuff look like how George Perez draws it in the comics.
Yeah.
You know, that sort of like frozen in at the apex of action sort of thing.
Yeah.
They have those tableaus that they moved to. You know, the first time I noticed it was in Civil War when they're running together at the on the tarmac. But in this case, that they've backed up even farther out, and there's this kind of like overhead perspective on a lot of the big nasty fights. So you can see Iron Man trying to flank him, and he's blocking it with like this shield made from debris. Mm-hmm. It's really clear and obvious what it is. And that's another thing that's why these fights are so good, is that you don't get lost in them. You know, right. You can see exactly. The cool action.
Exactly. And that is a big criticism that I've had of action movies recently, is that shaky cam. That shaky cam, you know, Jason Bourne kind of, it's like,
Transformers.
I actually don't know. I can't follow the action. Don't know what's happening.
Yeah. This is very clear.
Yeah, going back to
see splash pages as they were, you know, that's hitting these points and these great.
Oh, absolutely. You
know,
And by the way, going back, even for me, it goes back further than Civil War to Winter Soldier.
Right.
When I saw Winter Soldier, I was like, oh my God, thank you, Russo brothers, genius. Mm-hmm. And that's why I love that movie so much. And they've continued it through every single one of the films I've been involved in. This one's certainly no exception. But Mark called it. We were looking at panels of a comic and at splash pages.
Yeah.
And I sat there giggling almost in giddy glee.
It's like, delightful.
How did they do? Look what they did. This is amazing. So as a comic book fan, it just doesn't get better than this. It does not get better than this. Right. And it was brilliant.
Yeah. Well, the battle in New York that occurs with Cull Obsidian and Ebony Maw is certainly one for the ages. I personally immediately fixated on Ebony Maw. I thought, this is a character, or this is a villain or a monster or whatever the hell he was. He's articulate. He's mocking. He's vocal. And he's a telepath. So he's tossing things effortlessly, just by a thought, a mind thought, and things are flying through the air. He's hitting. He's using powers. He's floating. He's defying gravity. He's using all kinds. I mean, it is an amazing power on display in full, and you have to sort of swallow it in big chunks and go, oh, now he's doing that. Oh, what exactly is he doing? Oh, now he's doing that. Oh, this will get him. They didn't get him. Oh no. Okay, you know. And so you're learning. What I love about this with the Black Order is that you're learning about them along with our characters, along with our heroes. Right. We love our heroes, and we know what they can do. So when you see Doctor Strange go toe-to-toe with Ebony Maw, you think, oh, Doctor Strange can take him. Oh, shit, maybe he can't. What's going on here? What's he doing now? Oh, wow. You know? So I loved that, and it continues. Also joining the fray in a great pop-up moment is our own friendly neighborhood Spider-Man, who Peter Parker is on a bus. Spider sense is tingling. Of course, there's a gigantic donut spaceship hovering in New York. This is where we get our Stan Lee cameo. He's the bus driver who very funnily, very comedically says, what's wrong with you kids? Haven't you ever seen a spaceship before?
Yeah.
and of course, Spidey leaps into the fray, gets out of the bus and goes to join his fellows to fight these characters. Cull Obsidian is, you know, again, like the Hulk and Iron Man's having a bit of a tough time with him. Of course, Hulk himself is useless at this point because he does not want to come out. So they wisely get him out of the fight. It continues on until Strange is incapacitated and taken aboard the ship, the little drop ship from the Sanctuary 2, and Spider-Man goes along with them. And, of course, Iron Man follows suit. Ebony Maw is defeated really by Wong, who kicks him into another dimension or another area. He portals him into the Antarctic or something, and as he's trying to come back, closes the gate on his hand and locks off one of his hands. And it rolls down.
That's good stuff.
Did when we see him again, was he missing his arm?
He had a robotic arm. He had a metallic.
Okay, so they had replaced it with a metallic. I did not notice that. Wow.
Much like Nebula, apparently the Sanctuary is nothing but you're missing something. We'll put that right back in with metal, or you know, we'll pop that in piece by piece.
Nice.
But he was whole again when we saw him, or at least you know artificially whole. Okay, so now we go to the spaceship, and let's jump into space, because that's where we are now. We're in space, and we've got the Guardians of the Galaxy, who appear to the strains of Rubber Band Man, which is a great way for them to appear, with Peter Quill, a.k.a. Star-Lord, singing along, Gamora singing along, Drax sound asleep, and Rocket, of course, looking bored. Where are they going? They go to answer the distress call. Why are they doing this? Because somebody might need help, and there could be stuff to steal. Who knows?
Right.
They happen upon the dead Asgardians floating in space, and of course they encounter Thor. And this, my friends, my true believers, this is Marvel magic when they pull Thor on. Oh my gosh.
Yep.
You know, Thor, of course, is still alive. No doubt there. This is when they admire his unconscious form, calling him a cross between an angel and a pirate, and that he's like perfection, and his arms are amazing. And Quill starts to get a little nervous about this whole, you know, admiring of the thunder god on his ship. Mantis wakes him up, and we have an introduction of character. Yep. By the way, I want to point out that Teenage Groot is my son.
He's probably a lot of people's sons.
My son is a tall, thin, eternally bored and cell phone clutching and typing a teenager. And he just reminded me of Teenage Groot.
Oh my God, no. And then the whole, you know, I'm Groot.
Yeah.
It's like,
hey,
oh,
whoa,
my God.
Language.
Yeah, the language. And then, and then even better, the fact that that Groot language is an option in Asgard.
Yes. The Thor speaks it.
Yes.
That's wild.
It's genius. The Thor in this, it's really Thor kind of takes over the scene.
Oh yeah.
Because he becomes sort of the agent provocateur. You know, the Guardians are not in the fight until Thor basically tells them what's going on. And so I love that that you know, kind of without meaning to, Thor cuts across Peter Quill's bow. This is another ego clash that's really great. Yeah. I guess one of the nicest things about what they've done going forward after Guardians 2, Peter Quill has not appreciably been altered by the knowledge that he's half a god, right? He's still the same insecure man-child that he was, you know, and he's got some growing to do. And so I like the fact that he is insecure at this point still. You know, he and Gamora have made strides, but he's still working through some stuff.
Yeah.
So, and that's the beauty of that character, right? You know, from the whole posturing to him lowering his voice, and Drax, are you lowering your voice? No, you are. You just did it again. And it's funny. I mean, and just to show to the contrast, the guy who is a bag of insecurities and is constantly questioning himself with the supreme ego of Thor. Thor never questions that he is the best guy in the room, the toughest, best, coolest, meanest. And so to see those two up against each other, where Thor's completely oblivious of Peter Quill, he doesn't give a shit. Right. You know,
and he focuses on Rocket as captain. You must be the captain. Rabbit.
Yeah. Exactly. Rabbit.
Rabbit and tree.
Rabbit and tree.
That's my movie right there. I want Thor, Rabbit and Tree. I would, they don't have to do a movie, but a couple of webisodes would be great.
Yes.
Just let them go have their own little side quest.
And by the way, and that effect of Thor on the rest of the Guardians, like if anybody else had called Raccoon Rabbit, you know, Rocket would have been down their throats, but with Thor, he just kind of, his little mouth opened up and he just kind of cocked his head. And it's like, oh my God, because he realizes that Thor didn't say it to demean him or to insult him. It's just simply what he calls him, you know? And so it's just, again, another wonderful, brilliant encounter between characters that we know and love and have never seen together. And boom, there they are. The chemistry is amazing. The interaction is astounding. And you just want it to go on and on and on.
Unfortunately, it doesn't go on and on and on. Once Thor finds out that Gamora is Thanos' daughter, things get a little serious and dark. And I thought for sure, uh-oh, what's going on now? And Thor approaches Gamora and says, you are the daughter of the man who did what he did to me, to my friend, to my brother. And then, of course, he backs up and says, yeah, my family was pretty messed up, too. You know, it must be hard.
Yeah.
But he's got a quest, folks. Remember, I told you, he's very singularly minded. He needs a weapon. He needs a weapon capable of killing Thanos. And he knows where he can get this weapon.
He's going to go. It's specifically a god-killing weapon.
It's a god-killing weapon. Yes. Yeah. and he needs to get it forged by the same dwarven forges that made Mjolnir. Nidavellir, maybe the name of it.
I think it's Nidavellir.
Oh, there you go. You're our expert Norse mythology.
I have. No, it's great. No, I love the inclusion of that place. I love the inclusion of the big giant Peter Dinklage, who's a dwarf but is giant. By the way, that was my Red Skull moment, right? When Thor's like, I need a weapon. And I was like, see, oh my God, not even one movie passed and they're giving him a hammer back. I mean, hello, for those people who doubted, I don't know, man, Thor without his hammer isn't really Thor. Oh yeah, really? How long do you think, genius, they're going to go before they give him another freaking hammer? Yeah.
Anyway. And specifically, it's not just any hammer. For those of you that know your Thor comics, the hammer that he gets and the hammer that gets that ends up being forged is the hammer that Stormbreaker is actually what Beta Ray Bill's hammer was called.
Right. Yes. So, yes. Now it looks more like the hammer from the Ultimates.
Right.
But it is called Stormbreaker, which is exactly what Beta Ray Bill's hammer was called. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I actually like the look of Beta Ray Bill's hammer a little bit better than what Thor got. It's gold and it's a little shorter and it's got the axe hand. But what he ended up getting looked just fine. But
and it was an axe on one side, a hammer on the other. I mean, it's a god killing weapon, and he needs to go and get that forged. So he takes Rocket Raccoon and Groot, or Rabbit and Tree, with him and bids goodbye to the other morons on the ship. He doesn't mean that mean. He just calls them that because he thought that's what they were called. And gets on the pod and takes off. Meanwhile, Gamora and Star-Lord and Drax and Mantis, I suppose, are going to go where they know the other Infinity Stone is, and that is nowhere in the possession of the Collector.
Right.
When we last saw that stone, it was the Reality Stone at the end of Thor: Dark World, and it was given to the Collector for safekeeping. So they're going there. Gamora very, very darkly reminds everyone that if Thanos has all six stones, he could wipe out mankind and life in the universe with a snap of his finger, just like that. And so she says, that's always, as long as she's known him, it's been his goal.
Yeah.
So why is he doing this? What is going on inside Thanos's head? We get a flashback of Gamora's childhood and how she encounters Thanos. Would anyone like to take a shot at kind of overview of that one?
Well, this flashback was necessary for a couple of reasons. I think we had to establish this relationship between the two of them. While Thanos, make no mistake about it, Thanos is an abusive father, right? In every sense of the word, he's not incapable of love. Right. And the comic book Thanos has courted death because he wants to become a god and rule by her side. They took that out of the equation and instead gave him a more personal reason, that his own planet was essentially destroyed by, he didn't really say, but overpopulation,
the resources are taxed out.
It basically they mined it to down to the rock, and so he comes up with this solution, right? Let's not call it the anti-life equation because the distinguished competition would get mad, but essentially his response to this is, well, all I have to do is it's simple calculus. You know, I'll just reduce everything by half and then everybody will then have twice as much. Mm-hmm. And so he's very cavalier about how he does that. On Gamora's home world, you know, we're literally treated to Thanos. She catches his eye because she literally is not afraid of him. Everybody else is running and fleeing. And he says, where's my mommy? You know, and so I think that's where Thanos' children all come from. Those that show a spark, exactly. a spirit, those that yeah. he is sort of drawn to for one reason or another, or mm-hmm. show a certain aptitude, which is what Gamora demonstrates when he gives her the oddly ornate knife to play with.
Right.
And so, you know, at that point, we have the basis of this this situation. He even tells her not to look as they're killing
right.
half of the population, presumably mom too.
Right.
So
right.
so she becomes the adopted daughter mm-hmm. of her father's of her mother's murderer.
Yeah.
There's no way this is going to end well, you know, yeah, and. Right.
The way he talks to her, the way he talks to as a little girl and takes her by the hand and leads her and child, and he's talking to her so gently. And again, it's Josh Brolin, and he's kicking ass here, folks.
Right.
And he's doing it in a way that makes you kind of like him. I mean, I hate to say it, he's a mad titan and he wants to kill half the universe, but I kind of like him. And right. he's, you know, he brings her in there. And the thing about the knife was hugely important, because not only was it a weapon, and let's see how you do with this weapon. He talked about balance. He's holding this knife in his hand, and he's going, if it's too heavy in one direction or too heavy in the other direction, no. He's talking about what he's doing in his mission, his purpose, all an example of the balance of this knife. So it's very simple for him to explain to her, this has to happen. It has to be balanced. Otherwise, it falls one way or the other, you know? Masterfully done.
That scene just demonstrates, again, why the best approach for a villain, rather than make him a mustache twirling megalomaniac, is to write it as if he is the hero. He believes he is the hero of the story, and what he is doing must be done for the benefit of whoever, you know. And that is, again, what makes Thanos so completely compelling and fascinating. Is that he doesn't turn and you know, give the grimace and say, kill them all. No, he's not that guy. Right. That would have made him boring.
That would have made him a Steppenwolf.
Yeah, exactly. What are you doing here? I will conquer for Darkseid. Well, that's what it says right here in the script.
I see.
I'm just reading that. And talk about, you know, Syrian Hines. What a waste of Syrian Hines. Anyway, so Brolin has such... just an amazing delivery, the softness, like what you said, Joseph, the gentleness in his voice, you know, come here, little one, you know, and there is genuine care there. There was genuine care. I'm like, oh my gosh, I'm so conflicted about Thanos, because I should feel about him the way I felt about Steppenwolf, you know, stupid megalomaniac, somebody beat him up. And yet I'm going, you know, this guy has moments of tenderness. He's insane.
As he says, you know, I'm the only one that can do this, you know, he's the only, he feels that he loves enough, to actually, make the tough calls that no one wants to make, you know, that's, you know, that wouldn't be a bad, place to be in if the calls that he were making was killing people, you know?
Right. If it wasn't wiping out half of the life in the universe.
Yeah.
You know, No, so it's just that I very much enjoyed that flashback, establishing their relationship and showing how she became his daughter, because we're never really told that.
Right.
And so, that was just handled so well, so very well.
And Thanos is certainly a complex villain. He's terrifying, though. At every moment, I wasn't sure exactly what he was going to do. They called him mad. And yes, there is madness in his logic and a madness in his motivation. But overall, he maintained a composure that was to the best of the villains, you know, that you can think of. He was very calculating, maybe even a few steps ahead. Although towards the end, we'll talk about that. Later, there were some missteps I think we can discuss. I do want to really briefly go back onto Ebony Maw's ship. We have Tony Stark, we've got Doctor Strange, we've got Spider-Man. And of course, Strange is captured and he's being tortured by Ebony Maw to give up the Time Stone, because he's cast a protection spell over the amulet on the relic of which we'll not be talking about, to prevent him from taking it. So Spider-Man and Iron Man are there on the ship, and they go, "Well, what are we going to do? This guy's, you know, he's telekinetic. He's a badass. We got to get him off the ship."
And Spider-Man comes up with the greatest solution ever. He says, hey, have you ever seen that old movie Alien?
Yep.
Yep. And it, a brilliant way to, and takes him completely by surprise. I mean, the look on his face as he floated through space was very much like the look on Snoke's face laying on the room of the throne room going, what right. the hell yeah. just happened?
I yeah, did not like, see that coming.
Yeah, yeah, what
I
the hell? Who throws a person out of an airlock?
Come on. That's ridiculous. What a great thing. And now and our
by
heroes.
The way, the torture scene with yeah. Strange was really disturbing. I mean, you know, again, these characters are established and presented in such a way that, you know, you're not rolling your eyes at them. You're not yawning. You're just like, oh, holy cow. What is this vicious thing going to do next? Mm-hmm. And so very effective.
Those points that were piercing Dr. Strange, very reminiscent of the old needle, in the eye, horror covers, you know, where they would have some doctor holding a syringe about to inject yes. it right into somebody's eye, usually a damsel in distress. Yeah. but that whole idea of those multiple piercings was very to me it triggered an old pulp memory, you know. Oh, yeah. So that was wonderful.
And even when Squidward, as Tony Stark called him, even as Squidward delighted in the torture, he did say to Doctor Strange that he's been serving Thanos for years and he never fails. If he shows up without on Titan with and the stone is not in out of that amulet and in his possession, he was considered a failure, and that is unacceptable. So yep. you know, as thin motivation as that is. He still, everyone is afraid of Thanos. Everyone does right. not want to disappoint Thanos, yeah. even his quote unquote children. And when Ebony Maw is mentioned later on Titan during before the battle, when Thanos addresses Strange, he briefly mourns him because he's like, oh, I that's a heavy loss for me. I like yeah. that guy. You know, yeah. I like yeah. that guy. Speaking of heavy losses, we are getting the red eye, ladies and gentlemen, from our bouncer. We're not done, Maximilian.
We've still got more to do.
We have another half of a movie.
He does not care.
I'm sensing another half movie, so I'm sensing another podcast.
Yeah, I think we can probably get together very, very shortly and record the second half of this Infinity Wars podcast. Ladies and gentlemen, we hope that you tune into that second half. We will finish the movie. And we'll talk about a little bit more about how we took it and where we think it's going to go next, because we have some theories, ladies and gentlemen. The Gentleman Nerds is a Cloak and Dagger production, and it's written by Aaron Diarrive, Mark Finn, Ben Gibbs, and Joseph Fotinos, with additional material by Tanalir Tivan and Ebony Maw. Music composed and performed by the amazingly talented Ben Gibbs. Promotional material, logos, and the Gentleman Nerds mascot, I propose that we name him Red Skull. Created by artistic goddess Michelle Fitzpatrick. The Lobot Lounge bouncer is Maximilian, you spoke sport. And our special guest bartender is Marvel's Weasel, soon to be seen in Deadpool 2. Our sound editor, mixer, and intentional producer is Ben Gibbs. Our executive producer and the man we all pray never gets superpowers is Aaron Diarrive. The Gentleman Nerd's attorney is Dr. Gonzo. The Soul Stone is on the planet Vormir. The Infinity Gauntlet was forged by Etriel. Thanos' ship is named Sanctuary 2. And Mark Farnash is the man in the gorilla suit. Web hostings by Rustix Interactive. Technical assistance provided by Blythe Christopher Diarrive. Please join us in the Lobot Lounge. And next we open, we'll finish our discussion of Infinity War. Go on to the Lobot Lounge site on Facebook. Join in the conversation. Tell us your theories. Tell us what you think. We want to hear from you. Tip your bartenders and your waitstaff. Final words, Mark.
Stay tuned for part two. I have a theory I'm going to reveal that ties everything together like a Rosetta Stone.
Ooh, nice. I, as usual, nice. Mark Finn. Aaron.
Yes, I have only one thing to say. Loki lives.
Very nice. I'm Joseph Otinos, reminding you all, well, I'll see you on Vormir next time and we'll talk about it. Good night.
power.
No, absolutely.
He was assigned to be guardian of the Soul Stone, and now that it's gone, guess what, folks? He's free.
No.
Yep. Oh, doubt me again? Doubt me again.
I am.
Sure. Go ahead. See what happened the last time. Mr. Hey. Get ready for disappointment. No.
You are correct. This is
what I'd like to do.